I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. There is practical power in design. It can improve our quality of life and increase the value of places and products. One of its most accomplished and enthusiastic advocates is Jenny Winhall. Jenny develops design strategy for RED, a division of the Design Council of the UK. She and her colleagues at RED are using design to challenge conventional thinking on citizenship, agriculture, health, and energy, and she is our guest today on Smart City. Also with us is Dr. Stephen Shepherd. As an economist at Williams College, he's been working with the contemporary art institution, MassMoCA, to calculate the real value of arts to their communities. We'll talk about the power of design and art today on Smart City. But first, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Jenny Winhall develops design strategy for RED, a dynamic, future-oriented division of the Design Council of the UK. RED uses a design-based approach to challenge accepted thinking on familiar social and economic problems. Currently, the designers at RED are exploring issues of citizenship, agriculture, health, and energy use. Jenny, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Tell me how you are using design to challenge accepted thinking.
We actually like to think of ourselves as design venturers. We have a certain amount of funding every year that we use to run live projects that address different social and economic issues through design practice. And we do that by really essentially running a live project to explore a particular area. And once we've found an intervention that we think design might make within that space, then we make a proposal for further funding to take that forwards. And I guess the sort of issues we've been looking at so far have been citizenship, healthcare, and at the moment we're working on a project that's looking at domestic energy consumption. So the range is very, very different. But at the start, we never really know what design's going to be able to do within that space, and it's a process of looking at what's happening, what the key problems are, and I guess trying to find a space in which we can make a difference.
What do you think a design approach, design thinking, brings to an issue, for instance, like domestic energy consumption?
I think there are two different sides to designing. One, as you rightly say, is design thinking, and the other is design practice. Now, I think that design thinking is a very particular way of creative problem solving that can virtually be applied to any topic at all. And then design practice is the process of collecting together ideas, making them tangible, and presenting them in a meaningful form, whether that's as a new product, a new service, a new environment. So I guess that's the two sides of it. So when we've been looking at domestic energy consumption, we tend to, rather than coming from the architecture of the system, as I guess most policymakers or perhaps service providers do, we tend to come from the perspective of the individual, and we use a wide range of research techniques to understand, in this instance it would be the householder, to understand the householder's perspective, how they think about energy, how they use it, how the service appears to them. So we're really looking through their eyes. And I think that designers can always appear a little bit mysterious quite often when they're sort of shown in magazines or on television shows. It's as if the designer comes up with an idea from nowhere, and it's a kind of a magic idea. But actually, I think it's a much more straightforward process than that. And I think there are only really three things that designers do differently. The first is to look through the eyes of the individual. I think the second is to make things visible and tangible. So we have a good ability to make problems visible and ideas tangible. And the third thing, interestingly, is an ability to prototype. So that means that when we've come up with an idea, we put it into practice very quickly, either by building a quick mock-up of it, if it's a product or an environment, or by creating what we would call an experience prototype, if what we're trying to investigate is a new type of service or a new type of brand experience, say.
Now, RED is part of the UK Design Council. Tell me about the UK Design Council.
The Design Council itself has actually been around since 1944, which might surprise a few people, but we were originally set up to kickstart British manufacturing after the Second World War. The Design Council itself has gone through a number of different sort of personalities, if you like, from being really about, I guess in the 1980s, being very much a sort of style police kind of manifestation, to our current work now, which is much more about inspiring and enabling the best use of design in a variety of different sectors. In the last 3 or 4 years, we've made quite a dramatic shift from being about promoting design to actually helping people do it in practice and sort of proving the value of it.
And how did the idea of RED develop as a division or a unit of the Design Council?
The main thing for the Design Council is we're trying to open up new markets for design. And whilst we do have pieces of work going on with the more established applications of design, so for example, we have a 3-year piece of work going on with manufacturers, helping them to understand how design can improve their bottom line, increase customer loyalty, and all those more sort of obvious design values, I guess, or benefits. We also need to find new areas where design hasn't been applied before. So RED came about because of the need to run a kind of a short investigative kind of project and to run several of them over the year, and for the Design Council to be able to look at the work that's come out of that and decide what it wants to turn into a larger piece of work. There are 3 different directions in which our shorter projects, and by that I mean that some of them are a week long and some of them are 6 or 7 months long, there are several directions in which they might go after RED has finished with them, and we hope that either the Design Council will take them on as a 3-year campaign, or that a related body might take them on, or that the design industry themselves start to push the ideas forward. So I guess we see ourselves very much as design venturers, hoping that we can catalyse new markets.
Much of your work is focused on a government response or a government service. You did a wonderful project, I thought, on citizenship, exploring citizenship and critical points of citizenship, voting and becoming a citizen, and what that experience was like, as you say, from the perspective of the individual. And of course, your recommendations ultimately would have to be adopted by government for them to live. Do you see that happening? Are you talking with government officials about your work?
Oh, yes, we definitely are. In fact, we had quite strong interest from the Department of Constitutional Affairs on that particular project, especially around ways in which we might redesign the experience of voting, ranging from registering to vote in the first place right through to what it feels like to turn up at a polling station. So generally our work is very well received by policymakers, particularly because we're trying to address those knotty kind of problems that have been around for ages and which everybody sort of bashed their heads against a brick wall trying to solve. And I think the interest is that we come from, I guess, a very left field approach. It's not something that policymakers have come across before, but they see some value in it because we're often able to tap into the desires of the general public in a way that isn't perhaps as accessible to them as policymakers themselves.
You mentioned earlier that you use particular techniques to understand the perspective of the individual. In the case of the project on citizenship, which you called Touching the State, tell me about the techniques you used and what you learned from using those techniques.
As designers, we borrow techniques from a range of other disciplines. I guess that a designer always has a grab bag of research techniques to hand that have been stolen from areas like ethnography, anthropology, and other social sciences, psychology. What we do is we make them very rapid. So our research approach is very much based on insight. So we're looking for insights. We're not necessarily looking for truths so true answers to particular questions. We're looking for the odd things that people do or the way that they behave that surprises us. And that's where we gain a lot of our inspiration from, by thinking about the insights that we've uncovered through that research. So in the Citizenship Project, for example, we actually followed people through those experiences. So we attended citizenship ceremonies with people. We accompanied people to the courts when they were carrying out jury service. We went to the polling stations with them when they were casting their votes. And by observing what they were doing and by asking some of the more latent questions to uncover some of the more implicit thinking and feelings and emotional responses, we actually got a fairly clear picture of where the gaps were, if you like. So where the experience was falling down, where they were feeling turned off as citizens, and where they were feeling more engaged and valuable. So I guess our approach in that particular project was to consider each of those interactions with the state as a particular journey. And we could very clearly see, for example, when our research participants were awaiting jury service, the reactions that they had to the environment they were waiting in was having quite a profound effect on how valuable they felt as citizens in part of that process.
I think anyone who has served on a jury will empathize with your findings and hope that government officials and policymakers are listening. You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Jenny Winhall. She is design strategist with RED, which is a division of the UK Design Council. Your recommendations on touching the state generated, I know, at least one vehement response from a designer who argued that to treat citizens as consumers, which he perceived your project, at least in part, to be doing, was a terrible mistake. And you actually printed his response in your final report. How did you respond to his comments?
Well, we really did, to some extent, agree with him, and we thought it was important that we raised the debate around this issue. Many designers that we work with question whether design itself is a political activity, and I guess that's what we're keen to explore. That particular project for us, because it was only 8 weeks long, was certainly one of the more provocative pieces of work we do. So anything that we can do to raise the debate and get people thinking about the role of design in this space, whether they think there is a role or there isn't, is very useful to getting the attention onto the design industry and what we can achieve with the skills that we have.
You organize your work around projects, as you say, some of which are very short duration. What qualifies as a project for RED? How do you decide which issues you'll take on?
It tends to be a mixture of where we ourselves think we can make a valuable intervention and what's a kind of hot topic within the policy arena at that time. And also, of course, we're always making links with various senior government officials or commercial organisations or service providers. And if we can see an opportunity to link things up, then that's the kind of thing that we're looking at. We tend to go for the more challenging projects, certainly. I think if somebody were to ask us to simply, I guess, redesign a bus stop, that would be a very short project for us. It's still an extremely valuable piece of work to do, but we're looking at much more sort of systemic problems, I think. So what would happen is we would probably extrapolate that out into a bigger question about how we motivate people to take public transport, for example.
Let's talk about one of your current projects, the energy project. What is the problem you are attempting to solve or at least explore?
The brief for this project is really about understanding how we can cut carbon emissions from the domestic owner-occupied sector. So in London, for example, 40% of carbon emissions come from domestic households. When we use electricity or gas, we're very rarely aware of how much we're consuming and what that means in relation to anybody else, for a start, and what that means in relation to the environment. So what we've been looking at is how we can develop new products and new services that enable people to reduce both the amount of energy they consume and the way that they build in energy efficiency measures to the fabric of their homes.
Tell me about your approach to the project and what you've learned to date.
To start the project, we visited a range of householders, so people who had just moved into their first house, people who had just started a family, people who were on their third or fourth house and perhaps ready to retire and downsize. So different, various ranges of householders, and asked them to tell us about their experience of using energy. Now, we didn't do it in such a direct way. I mean, what we often find is that if you have a sort of a questionnaire and you ask people those specific questions, they'll give you the answers that they think you want to hear. So we took a slightly different tack, and we asked people to do some much more sort of playful exercises, for example, to draw what energy meant to them. And we asked them to imagine new types of services, what would help them. We did that by using a sort of a set of cards with provocative names of non-existent services, and then asking them to imagine what that service might be. I mean, first of all, we really understood that energy is invisible most of the time and people don't think about it. The only touch point, if you like, that they have with an energy service is the bill. And then the only touch points they have with the appliances they're using and using electricity, of course, are the switches and the plugs and the sockets. So it's very, very sort of basic interaction. So we're really looking for where the meat is. And we think that one of the strongest things we can do is to bring some element of visibility into the home. So we've been investigating some of the products that are already on the market that allow you to monitor your energy use. And of course, what we're finding is that they're all based on numbers, which don't necessarily mean anything to anyone. The same as when you receive your bill, it's a list of numbers and a cost. And that doesn't really give you any kind of sense of where you've used that energy, whether that's a sort of average amount of use, whether you should be using less, what impact that's having on the environment, whether you are wasting a proportion of the energy that you're using, or whether you're being efficient in using that. So that's certainly one of the strategies that we'll be looking at there, is how to create some kind of home monitoring visualization tool. And I guess there are a number of different ways we could do this. We could do it in a very sort of ambient way, which there's something in the living room and out of the corner of your eye you might see that the energy use is sort of greater or lesser in some way. Or it could be a more sort of technical interface in the kitchen, where you can see which lights are switched on, which appliances are on standby, because of course that wastes a lot of energy, and perhaps how well your house is doing in comparison to other houses, for example, in terms of energy efficiency.
Tell me how you find your team members for a project like this one. I would think you would have to sort of beat designers off with a stick, because it sounds like so much fun.
It is. I mean, it's great fun. This particular project we're carrying out in a very ordinary house in the south of London. So we try and obviously we base our projects as close to the context of the project as possible. So the team, which is about, I think, 9 people strong at the moment, are camped out in this tiny little house. But it's really so that we can understand the context in which we're working. We don't have sort of wild ideas that average sort of Joe Public wouldn't be able to deal with in his own house. But as for the team members, we have a core team of designers. My director, Hilary, is an anthropologist by background, and obviously her work has been very much to do with architecture and design and social policy. We always have a policy expert working with us. We often have an economist working with us. And apart from that, we tend to draw in expertise as and when we need it. So the health work that we've just completed, we brought in a doctor, a health policy expert, a psychologist, a sports fitness personal trainer. As the project developed, we realised that we ourselves lacked certain expertise, so we pulled that in. I think that the point is that we have a number of designers with different backgrounds working with us. So we have product designers, interaction designers, graphic designers, communication designers. But being able to create an interdisciplinary team around the project means that as designers, we don't have to be experts in any field other than design. And really, we're tapping into all the sort of expertise that there is existing in that sector already to create the right kind of team for the project.
You mentioned the health project you did. I thought you produced some very interesting ideas about co-creating health services. What is the opportunity there both to make us healthier and certainly reduce cost?
Well, our health service, which is a great service, is really in a period of crisis at the moment. It was essentially designed in the 19th century around the problems of treating infectious diseases. And so now that we're in the 21st century and the issues are much more about escalating chronic disease, we find that we've got a service that doesn't quite know how to react to these new issues. So for example, the types of chronic diseases that we're looking at are diabetes, chronic heart disease, Alzheimer's, these kinds of things. And they're not conditions that can be cured. So it means that as more and more of us suffer from these conditions, there's a greater and greater burden put on the National Health Service to treat us, to take care of us, and to give us medication. And of course, what that means is that the service itself is overstretched and overburdened. I think that by 2030, 1 in 10 of us will have diabetes, and the incidence of chronic disease itself will have more than doubled. So it really is a kind of a tidal wave of extra work for the health service that's heading our way. Now, the only thing that we can do about that is to switch the money and the attention into self-management of those conditions. So we can think about enabling people to help themselves, as it were, and going even further back to preventing the onset of those conditions in the first place. Now, through our investigation into this area, we looked particularly at diabetes as an example of a chronic disease, and we also looked at exercise as an example of the preventative healthcare side. I think what we began to see is that the NHS itself is not the best vehicle to create the kind of support that we might need in the future. The reason for that is that as a service, it's very much set up to deliver treatment. So it's set up to, you have a consultation with a doctor and they prescribe something and you take it. Now, with chronic conditions then, and obviously the preventative healthcare side, it's much more about helping people to live a healthy lifestyle. And that's not something that you can give them. You can't give somebody a fit body and a healthy diet. That's something they have to do for themselves. So what we've tried to do is to think about co-creation as a means to create a system that, rather than being burdened by demand, is actually strengthened by participation. And by co-creation, we're talking about the kinds of things like Linux, so that's open source coding, the way that people collaborate to improve on the original source code and to add derivatives to it. And I guess games like the Sims, where people are creating their own characters and their own pieces of code to link back into that system. And we've been trying to think, okay, well, if people have become experts in their own healthcare, which they are, by the time you've got a chronic disease, I mean, you know what works for you and you know what you have to do, how can we enable them to co-create their own healthcare in collaboration with professionals rather than being on the receiving end of delivered treatment?
Jenna, you're doing fascinating work, and it's important for all of us to know about. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Jenny Winhall is design strategist for RED. After a short break, we'll return to talk to Otis White about urban renewal in the unlikeliest places. And in the second half of our show, we'll talk with Dr. Stephen Shepherd, an economist at Williams College, about the impact of arts on the economic success of their communities. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, I've been reading about the revival of neighborhoods that we once thought were completely off limits in both New York and L.A. Tell us about them.
Yeah. Now, how is this for a turnaround? The South Bronx. You may remember that when Ronald Reagan was running for president in 1980, he visited the South Bronx because he said it was the perfect example of urban policy that had gone wrong. So we're obviously talking about a place that was pretty desolate. And then there's South Central L.A. You may remember that was the scene of the riots in the early 90s in Los Angeles. These places are actually starting to turn around. There are artists and writers and other people who are moving into lofts and row houses in the South Bronx, and they're starting to see antique shops and art galleries and even good restaurants that are turning up in the South Bronx. And the reason for it is pretty simple. It's a very well-located place. I mean, it's easy to get to Manhattan from the South Bronx, and the rents there are, by New York standards, very, very cheap. A 1,000-foot square loft you can get in the South Bronx for $1,350 a month, which is very, very cheap. As one person said, for that, you get a closet in Manhattan. So the rents are bringing folks in, good location. The atmosphere is starting to turn around. And a somewhat similar thing is happening in the South Central L.A. area, where, believe it or not, median sale values of houses there have increased at twice the regional rate of increase. So the home values are really going up in the South Central area. There aren't quite as many outsiders coming in, but people are buying homes in South Central and in the South Bronx. And these are two places that you could not have persuaded anyone to move to 10 years ago. By the way, the South Bronx has a nickname now. Do you know what it is?
Tell me about it.
SoBro. You've heard of SoHo? Well, they've got SoBro for South Bronx.
Okay, well, it's a little derivative, but it will do. Thanks for the news from unlikely places, and it's all good news for cities. Thanks, Otis. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay, Carol.
You're listening to Smart City. Dr. Stephen Shepherd is director of the Center for Creative Community Development and professor of economics at Williams College. His work is focused in the fields of urban economics, land use regulation, housing markets, local public finance, and environmental economics. Steve, thanks so much for being our guest today on Smart City.
I'm happy to be here.
Tell me about the work of the Center for Creative Community Development, or as you call it, C3D.
Yes, we call it that simply to save ourselves the exercise of going through the long name. Our focus is to try to dig deeper behind the economics and sociology of what's happening in communities that appear to be responding, developing, revitalizing due to cultural organizations and the arts. So the project grows out of some initial collaboration and discussion that I had with Joe Thompson, who's the director of MassMoCA, the Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art, located next door to Williamstown in North Adams, Massachusetts. This project started as a dream of some people in the art department and the director of the Williams College Museum of Art in the late 80s, and struggled back and forth throughout the 90s, and it was eventually secured public funding and opened up in 1999, and it's really had an impact on the community of North Adams. North Adams, prior to MassMoCA, had been hit with a virtually every post-industrial decline problem that a small city can be hit with. Their major employer had closed. They'd lost thousands of jobs. Their unemployment was the highest in the state of Massachusetts. Virtually every measure of social pathology was present in the highest levels in North Adams. So people realized something had to be done, and the state provided $35 million of funding to get this museum up and running. And it really has made a difference. What we're trying to do is to focus in great detail on a small number of case studies to see how this process works, measure it, try to identify the factors in a city that make it work better, that may present roadblocks or obstacles, and in general explore the usefulness of the strategy of using the arts and cultural organizations more generally as a community development and economic revitalization strategy.
It's not an obvious replacement strategy to go from loss of industrial jobs to the creation of arts jobs and then the what has a spillover or spinoff effect from those jobs. So where did the notion, how did that notion develop, and how did it develop legitimacy?
You've hit exactly on a central difficulty. Suspicion about this idea, and that this was, oh, this was just a dream of a few eggheads who would like to have another museum. Some people view the arts as primarily something that's done for elites or a particularly well-educated segment of society, and there was a lot of controversy about this, the idea that, well, what we need are real jobs in the community, not something to do with art or artists. I mean, most people still, when they hear the artist, the word artist, they think of starving coming right before it. And so it's with difficulty that it's developed legitimacy. That's part of what we're trying to understand, is both the sociology of that and to see what the actual result has been. I don't think we can say in our research to date that it is a complete replacement. I think that culture and the arts forms an important part of a broader strategy. Culture and the arts help to attract people to a community. They increase the quality of life in a community. They can, in that way, help to lay the groundwork for economic development in other areas. And so I think it's a critical and important part of the strategy, but it continues to be controversial. I mean, what we're finding is the economic impact comes through three important pathways. The first pathway is that there is a direct and important employment and income generation impact that happens through the arts. These are large organizations. They employ people in the production of culture. Mass MoCA, for example, brings well over 100,000 people a year to North Adams. They visit the museum. They make purchases in the town. They're still working on strategies for trying to make those purchases more frequent and larger in magnitude, but there is an impact there that has brought restaurants, that has brought some galleries, brought other sorts of businesses to North Adams that weren't there before. So direct employment and income generation in the sector and in related sectors is one pathway. A second important pathway that these organizations affect communities is by affecting the desirability of the community as a place to live. People enjoy living in communities where there's a vibrancy that is associated with the arts, where people can not only have the arts for entertainment, but can associate with other individuals who are there in the art scene, as it were. And that change in the quality of life changes the attractiveness of the community, it changes the demand for residents in the community, and that in turn is directly measurable via changes in the price of housing. The third pathway that we have measured and analyzed is the way that the arts bring people from different neighborhoods, different types of people together. The way I like to think about it is that the arts and cultural organizations serve as a type of crucible within which people come together and within which social capital is formed. There's been a lot of concern, as you know, about the demise and decline in social capital in American society and in U.S. cities in particular. And I think the arts and cultural organizations provide a possible strategy for reversing that trend and rebuilding social capital. It may be the case that we're all bowling alone in 2005, but we're not all going to the museum alone. And when we go to the museum, or when we go to a dance party, or we go to a performing arts event, we encounter other people there, we interact with them, we learn about them in subtle and important ways that help make other aspects of our social interactions work more smoothly. And so we've been studying what sorts of neighborhoods are attracted by arts organizations. In the case of Massimoca, we're able to actually look and see on a day-by-day basis which neighborhoods come together on any given day for a performing arts event or for to visit the galleries. We're undertaking similar types of analysis for another of our case study sites, the Mexican Fine Arts Center and Museum in Chicago, and also the Colquitt Miller Arts Council that does the marvelous Swamp Gravy production in Miller County, Georgia. So in all of those cases, we're able to see a tremendous variety of neighborhoods that are pulled together. Even though they're geographically quite separate, people from those neighborhoods come together and interact in these cultural organizations.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Dr. Stephen Shepherd. He is director of the Center for Creative Community Development and professor of economics at Williams College. Steve, are all arts investments created the same?
Absolutely not. The return to starting a cultural organization is one that is realized within the community. And so it's usually someone with a passion for a community that gets this process going. Part of what we want to understand is, and to undertake, is to provide some carefully done, defensible, quantitative measures of the ways in which communities benefit, so that these people with these passions can, when they approach communities and ask for support in their plan to create a cultural organization, they can point to this kind of evidence and say, listen, studies show that the following benefits can be expected if we undertake this endeavor.
I want to go to the ways in which you are trying to measure the impact, but first I want to understand again this question of, you know, are all arts institutions or community investments created the same? And happily, there are lots of people with passion. And happily, there are lots of people with passion for the arts who want to create new arts endeavors. But investing in Massimoca may pay off, where investing in something else may not. How can a decision maker know which investment is likely to pay off and which is not?
And to what extent? That is exactly the question we're interested in. So you're right. But what got me as an economist specializing in cities and urban areas interested in this project was looking at North Adams and Massimoca and saying to myself, okay, it's sort of working here, but why is that happening? For one thing, Western Massachusetts, where it's located, is already branded and identified as a cultural tourism destination. Within basically an hour's drive, a little more than an hour's drive of Massimoca, you have Tanglewood, where the Boston Symphony Orchestra plays every summer. You have the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge. You have the Clark Art Institute in Williamstown, the Williamstown Theater Festival. You have a whole set of other cultural organizations. Is that required for this sort of success? Or is the fact that none of those are contemporary arts organizations, is it required that Massimoca be doing something different or unique for the area? Massimoca itself, the majority of its programming is not directly grounded in the community. Other organizations, for example, the Mexican Fine Arts Center and Museum or Swamp Gravy, are both undertaking programming that's very grounded in the community where they're located and from which they sprang. And we're trying to understand the importance of that difference. We don't have a final answer on all that, but that's exactly what we're interested in identifying are, what are the factors that contribute to the success? Because not all of these are going to succeed.
Do you have any ideas about what you will find based on your early research?
Well, one thing that we found that really surprised us is the way that these organizations are capable of attracting visitors from very diverse neighborhoods. I was already expecting, and there have been a variety, the Americans for the Arts have done marvelous studies about local economic impacts and employment generation resulting from the arts, and there have been other people who undertook those sorts of investigations. It's been a little less common to look at the impacts on housing markets and property revitalization, but there have been some examinations of that. What there hadn't been that I'm aware of prior to our work is some careful analysis of the diversity of neighborhoods who are attracted to arts organizations. Now, part of the reason for that is just that the data are not often collected. So most arts organizations do not routinely collect information on the neighborhood that every visitor or patron comes from. Mass MoCA is one of the few that do undertake that kind of information collection, and so we're very fortunate in that case to analyze it. So one thing we've discovered is that there are very diverse neighborhoods that are attracted to an arts organization. Even one like Mexican Fine Arts Center with a very clear, specific cultural identity. I mean, it is very much grounded in the Latino community of Chicago, but it's drawing an audience from all over Chicago and more widely from around the country and the region. So that's something that we're able to quantify and look at that's not been routinely done.
We only have a few minutes left, and I want to shift the conversation and talk briefly about another piece of work you did, the price of access to better neighborhoods. You calculated the extra premium people are willing to pay to live in better neighborhoods. What did you learn?
It's very interesting. That study, I mean, this is the kind of thing I've been doing for a long time. I've spent the better part of the last 20, 25 years trying to understand the way in which housing markets and markets in general mediate access and limit or facilitate access to different sorts of neighborhoods, whether this is different quality schools, different access to open space and environmental amenities, etc. And in general, what we tend to find is that something on the order of 20 to 30% of the value of a house can be thought of as what people are paying for access to neighborhood.
And you wrote, trying to reduce social segregation and exclusion by planning for mixed neighborhoods is as likely to be effective as applying leeches to cure a fever.
The reason we say that is because, I mean, this is an important issue to think about, because as long as we don't have residence permits in this country, people are allowed to move to where they want, to purchase houses, and as long as houses are free to be sold or rented at market rates, that means that the price of housing and therefore the access to particular neighborhoods will be governed by market conditions. So what that means is the ability of public policy to simply say, we want lots of access to this beautiful neighborhood. You can't just say that, because any properties that get built in that neighborhood will go up in value as other people bid to have the right or privilege of living there. So I think that was a pessimistic note on the efficacy of public policy in housing markets that are really governed by open market conditions.
If you are a public official reading your study, what would you conclude about where leverage exists to build value in your city's neighborhoods?
One of the surest ways to keep access from neighborhoods from happening is by restricting the ability to build new housing and to provide housing. I know that it's not always going to be popular to say we have to allow houses to be built in this neighborhood so that we can ensure some sort of access. But I think one avenue that's open to public policymakers is to try to ensure that new housing can be produced. I think another avenue that can be effective is to make sure that the new housing that is produced in a neighborhood is of a sufficiently diverse spectrum of sizes and cost as to at least offer some hope of accessibility and affordability.
Well, let me bring this back full circle. As a public official, how should I think about investing in amenities?
That is a great question, because one of the things that I think is really a shame in most American cities is the way environmental amenities are primarily provided at the urban periphery, so that open space that's preserved is primarily preserved at the urban periphery, where it's most accessible to the most affluent members of our communities. I think that public officials should endeavor to achieve geographic dispersity, that is to disperse amenities throughout the urban area. I think that provides the most equal access to these amenities. That means you can't always be trying to concentrate everything in the city center as well. In the same way as I would be, I'm a strong supporter of open space preservation in the urban interior. I'm also in favor of whatever you can do to make cultural amenities available throughout. So, you know, one of the things I like a lot about the Mexican Fine Arts Center Museum is it's not down in the middle of Chicago along with all the other museums. In fact, it's the only officially sponsored museum in Chicago that's not there in the Loop and Central Museum area. It's out in an older suburb that was previously predominantly East European and Czech and is now primarily Mexican-American.
Dr. Stephen Shepherd is director of the Center for Creative Community Development and professor of economics at Williams College. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. City View's commentator Walker Smith says urban design and redevelopment are not just about the bricks and mortar of the project. They're about the technological bells and whistles, too.
The smart houses under development today utilize sophisticated technology platforms that enable us to live in interior environments that are actively responsive to our individual preferences. The smart houses to come will do more than simply react to our directions. They will learn and adjust automatically. Home entertainment systems and wireless security systems that also control heating, cooling, and lighting have already enabled millions of us to self-invent some portion of our lives. The tidal wave of home renovation during the post-2001 mortgage refinancing boom accelerated the diffusion of these basic systems by turning home remodelers, in the words of science writer James Glick, into home systems integrators. The next wave of smart houses will wrap us even more tightly in self-personalized physical environments. Homes that learn an individual's morning routine, homes that monitor health and then recommend a menu or contact the doctor, homes that read food labels, homes that keep track of activities and provide reminders and prompts, homes that enhance sleep patterns and bathroom routines. The word is getting out that people should expect home to be a place where self-invented experiences can be created and enjoyed. The same is true of fashion. Wearable computers are making it possible for us to completely determine the personal environment within which we live. Fashion-forward technologies can integrate earpieces into earrings, microphones into necklaces, and cameras into eyeglasses. Many observers contend that the handheld wireless devices carried by millions today are, in effect, primitive wearable computers. While some critics scoff that no one will don RoboCop-looking outfits, others point out that lots of people already go through life with headphones plugged into their skulls. USA Today writer Kevin Maney argues that it's a mistake to, quote-unquote, underestimate how stupid people are willing to look in order to take advantage of innovative technologies. Besides, these technologies are becoming inconspicuous. In 2004, Adidas announced the introduction of a $250 running shoe called One that has a sensor connected to a microprocessor and a motor to adjust the cushioning of the shoe in real time. People see that from here it is but a short step to the next generation of computer-enhanced fashions that will create self-personalized experiences for the wearer. Indeed, all of this is reflective of a broader social phenomenon. We have come to expect the ability to be self-inventive in every aspect of our lives, whether technology plays a role or not. And so you see this in a variety of other ways. Religion is being self-invented because we feel free to pick a religion that fits our personal taste. Dean Hoag, professor of sociology at Catholic University of America, has noted that so-called religion switching is now more common than at any point in American history. Similarly, we are defining our race and ethnicity in self-inventive ways. In the 2000 census, 42% of those choosing Hispanic as their ethnicity chose no racial category at all, marking instead the box for quote-unquote some other race. The traditional census categories no longer suffice to reflect the racial identities that many of us have defined for ourselves. Self-invention is the wave of the future, a future that we will dictate for ourselves. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City Broadcast, sign up for our podcast, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter. Thanks to Charles Edwards at Georgia Public Radio for his production assistance. Jeffrey Reddick edits Smart City. Our theme music was created and performed by Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.
National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and communities.